Our guest this hour says there has to be a better way to treat the dying that does not focus on saving life at any cost. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We are going to hear the story about the death of our guest's father and how it made her question how we treat the dying. And we will welcome your thoughts, your questions, and your experiences, too. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Have you ever cared for a dying spouse or parent? What would you have changed about the process? Let me welcome our guest. Katie Butler is a science writer whose work has appeared in many publications, including the New Yorker and New York Times magazine. She is the author of Knocking on Heaven's Door, The Path to a Better Way of Death. Good morning.
Good morning, Joy.
Your story is about your father's death. Your father's story starts with a stroke. But you ultimately blame a pacemaker that he has inserted in him for keeping him alive longer than he should have been. Why don't you walk us through the events following his stroke?
Sure. My father had a stroke at the age of 79. He'd lived a very vigorous, full life up until then. A year after the stroke, he needed a hernia surgery. And because he had a slow heartbeat, the cardiologist would not clear him for surgery unless he got a pacemaker. Now, his slow heartbeat had not created any physical problems for him. This was kind of a just-in-case decision. And at the time, it seemed like a very minor medical decision. But as the years went by, and my father had multiple small strokes and descended into dementia and near blindness and really total helplessness and misery, it was just agonizing to watch. And he actually said things to my mother like, "I'm living too long."
And the batteries on that pacemaker were going to last for another 5 years or more while his health was in had declined.
Exactly, and this is sort of points to a larger problem, which is that what seems like a minor medical decision is often very rushed in our present medical culture. Doctors are not given enough time to spend with so that they really know patients. And so we had no idea that this pacemaker had a 10-year battery when it was put in. We had no idea that it could be painlessly disabled, and we had no idea that we had the legal and moral right to have it disabled at the point where it was no longer serving a good purpose.
And your mother asked you to help her disable the pacemaker. Tell us about that.
Yes, my mother asked the cardiologist if he would disable it, and he refused. Well, he told us that we would have to get a court order in order to get it done, even though my mother was my father's legally designated medical decision maker at that point. So she asked me if I would help her get it turned off, not literally that we were going to put a magnet over his chest, which is in fact what they do in hospices, but that I would help walk her through the legal process of finding a doctor who would agree to do this.
Yeah, and how did that feel for you?
It felt absolutely horrible, because even though I knew my father was suffering and my mother was suffering as his long-term 24-hour-a-day caregiver, being put in a position with your parents where you are actively trying to remove all the barriers to a natural death is a terrible, terrible feeling. And it's a new thing for our generation. Past generations did not have to make these kind of decisions. And looking back, I have no regrets about what we did. I only wish my poor father could have died at the point when death would have been a blessing rather than a curse. But at the time, it didn't feel like that. It felt like wandering through the fog, trying to do the loving thing, the kind thing, the moral thing, but really not knowing what that was.
Yeah. And can you tell us What happened?
Well, the doctors, the cardiologist refused. I called a wonderful organization called Compassion and Choices, which has a hotline you can call and get advice on how to proceed with and getting you know, restoring your medical rights and your medical autonomy. But in the meantime, my father developed pneumonia, and my mother decided not to treat it. And so my father was eventually, you know, admitted to a palliative care program and then to hospice. And he died on a hospice unit inside a hospital.
Yeah. Well, some people might say that we do have, you know, these hospice care and palliative care, and that that is the path to a better way of death.
Absolutely.
Are your thoughts? What are your thoughts on?
I think palliative care and hospice are just incredible, and it's a pity that so few people even know palliative care exists. It's kind of a middle ground between all-on medical care of trying to maximize longevity and hospice. You don't have to be dying to be in a palliative care program, but it is the pathway to a better way of death. The problem is it's majorly underfunded. If someone works full-time as a palliative care doctor with no, you know, other kind of support, he might make $40,000 a year. The hospice benefit only pays the hospices about $150 a day per patient. So essentially, we pay the doctors who do very, very high-tech invasive procedures intended to prolong life or postpone death or avoid death, and about three times as much as we pay people in the hospice, palliative care, primary care system.
Yeah, and your father's long journey not only hurt him, but hurt your mother, or at least affected your mother in that she was his primary caregiver. Talk about how this isn't just about the patient.
Yeah. I think we have a tendency in America kind of to focus on the individual rather than, let's say, the family. And in the case of dementia, I really think there are two victims. There's the person who has dementia, and then there is the full-time caregiver whose health often suffers amazingly. In my mother's case, she had practiced yoga, she had friends, she used to knit, she used to sew, and really, her entire life went on hold at the point that my father had his stroke, and it stayed that way for 6.5 years. And I now have her journal that she kept during those years. And again, it's just heartbreaking to read it, to read an account of a weekend where my father continued to brush and rebrush his teeth. And no matter what she did, he would keep going back up to the bathroom and rebrush his teeth. And you know, this poor lady was in her early 80s herself, and it was absolutely devastating. And she had been married to my father for over 60 years, and she loved him dearly. And she got to the point where she said things like, "Talk about quality of life. What about mine? Sometimes I wish he would die and set me free." And what I think matters to me about this is, I mean, there's always been suffering attached to old age, sickness, and death. But I feel like we're creating a whole layer of unnecessary suffering because our standard medical system just doesn't know when to switch from trying to prolong and extend life to what the palliative care people call comfort care, where you really pay attention to quality of life. You don't subject people to dangerous treatments that may or may not give them an extra couple of months of what's become a very miserable life.
Then your mother's death a few years later was a much different process. How was it different?
My mother took a lot of lessons away from our experience with my father's dying. She developed two leaky heart valves. She checked out a surgeon. She asked a lot of questions. And she decided to decline the surgery because it had major risks of stroke and dementia. And she did not want to go down the path she had seen my father take. She refused that surgery. She had a heart attack 5 months later. She was admitted to a hospice program. And a month later, she had what was probably a second heart attack and was taken to the inpatient hospice unit, where she died about 24 hours later. She had time because she knew by declining the surgery that she was seeing the end of her life. She could see that the end of her life was coming. She had time to reconcile with family members. She had time to express her love to me. She had time to tell me that she wanted me to give her sewing machine to a woman who really sewed. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was really still a tough death. I don't think it's ever easy to lose somebody that you love. And in a sense, I felt like she died too soon, whereas my father died too late. Nevertheless, when I look back, I think she left all of the family members with a lot more peace and resolution than we felt in the course of my father's very long, drawn-out process of dying.
You say that some of the changes that need to take place have taken place with the Affordable Care Act?
Not so much. Mm-hmm. I think we're starting to see a beginning of changes. But the medical lobby is one of the third most powerful lobbies in Washington. And the result is that Medicare has essentially been distorted in its reimbursement systems to reward cure over care. And it's going to take a lot to change this. Anytime there's any kind of a pushback to try to change the way end-of-life care happens in America, there's a lot of pushback from the makers of medical devices, from the highly paid specialties. And so this is not going to happen without the political and grassroots involvement of caregivers and patients who want Medicare to fund a better way of death a lot better than it does now.
We are talking with Katie Butler. She's a science writer. And her book is Knocking on Heaven's Door, The Path to a Better Way of Death. And we welcome your questions for her. We welcome your experiences. Maybe you have a story like Katie's. Have you ever cared for a dying parent or a spouse? What would you like to see to change the process? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Knock, knock, knocking on heaven's door. Knock, knock, knocking on heaven's door. We are talking this hour with the author of Knocking on Heaven's Door, The Path to a Better Way of Death. Katie Butler watched her father's health decline for many years in the wake of a stroke. He ended up having a pacemaker installed for a non-threatening heart condition, which enabled his heart to keep beating while he lost many other functions and slipped deeper into dementia. She concluded that there has to be a better way to treat the dying that does not focus on saving life at any cost. And we wonder if you have any questions or experiences you'd like to share. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. We have Rich in Rhinelander with us first. Hello, Rich.
Thanks. Contrasting example, our father gave the family a great gift. It'll sound cruel, but it isn't. Came in off the lake from fishing, walked across the living room rug, and was dead. And it was horrible for us. It was a great shock. Our mother, on the other hand, who survived him by many decades, wound up in a nursing home in Tomahawk, Wisconsin, with good doctors, good medical care, and an excellent family friend as the person who headed up the nursing home. But she had wanted to come home to die in her own bed. She had a couple of dogs, and because I was not very well informed at the time, I'll admit that, about hospice options and whether a doctor would give the 6-month status approval, you know, for authorizing hospice in the home. She had congestive heart failure. But my message to families is that if you have a parent who is at the end stages of life and says, I'd really want to be home in my own bed and die in my own bed with my family present. She died in the nursing home at night, and we received the call, and I had a comeback from southern Wisconsin. I was in mid-career at the time. That's our lesson, basically, that sometimes you just have to follow your gut feeling, and when you don't, later on you say, it wasn't a terrible mistake, but it was a big enough mistake that we wish we had brought her back to the house, got her set up in her own bed, and gone through the inconvenience, actually, is what it was, of seeing her die in her own environment.
Rich, I'm sorry for the pain that you felt over that. Katie, any words of consolation?
Yeah, very important call, and a lot of wisdom there. It's a hard one, and it can help others. 3/4 of people want to die at home, only 1/4 do, and 1/5 die in intensive care units. Part of the problem is that we can't face death, and we sometimes have unrealistic expectations of medicine. And part of it is things like hospice is easy to get into if you have a terminal cancer, and it's tougher to get into if you have a vaguer diagnosis, let's say like congestive heart failure. But it is possible. You may have to shop around for a doctor who will certify that you will die within 6 months. But you should really push, because it's a benefit people paid for, and it's so valuable, and it actually saves the healthcare system money in the long run.
It sounded like this happened some time ago, too, so things might be a little bit different. But it's hard on an adult child. Rich and his family don't know the ins and outs of hospice care and palliative care, and you really, I don't know, it seems as though there ought to be more help for the family.
I totally agree, and I felt that very much in the course of the events that led to the book, which was at a time when you really need to be held in the arms of a loving community, and you don't really want to do a lot of thinking, you don't want to have to be really assertive with a medical system, you're actually, it's demanded of you, because if you don't get yourself up to speed on what you're contending with, which is really a broken and very fragmented medical system that is biased towards extending life no matter what. If you don't get up to speed on what you're contending with, you may go down a path, or someone you love dearly may go down a path that you just don't want to go down. For example, people in nursing homes are sometimes bounced back and forth between emergency rooms and hospitals so that they, in the dying process, they may be transferred to a hospital, and it has nothing to do with their comfort. It has to do with fears of liability or economic incentives or disincentives.
Let's go next to Kitty in Lake Mills. Hello, Kitty.
Hi, how are you?
Very good.
I want to thank you so much for this program. Similar experience in that, like many daughters, I became the caregiver for parents as they died, and in-laws, and my mother cared for my dad for, I believe, 14 years following a stroke. So, yeah, and then that dying kind of led me in the journey to study chaplaincy, and I became a chaplain at a Madison hospital and then worked with hospice, and I can't reinforce enough what the guest is saying today, and I'm so glad she's on. There is such a need, but I would say that in a hospital, if you find the chaplain, you will often find the person who can sort of interface between the patient, the family, the physicians, and the hospice and or palliative care team, provided there is one and it's funded. It's something that has to change, and I just can't thank you enough for this.
Well, thank you, Kitty, and bless you for the work you do. Find the chaplain is one thing, Katie?
Yes, I think it is, and it indicates something. Dying used to be regarded as a spiritual ordeal, and it's now become a technological flail. And the chaplains are the among the few people in the hospital who can bring back at least some sense of the sacred into what's become kind of a sterile environment. And when I was living the events of Knocking on Heaven's Door, while my father was dying in the hospital, there was a wonderful Anglican chaplain who showed up, and gave my father last rites, even though he had been an agnostic for 20, I don't know, probably 50, 60 years. It gave me a tremendous sense of relief to have at least some sacred ritual in which I could, with the depths of my soul, say goodbye to my father. So it's wonderful things can be done even in the hospital environment.
So what sorts of systems need more money? Exactly how does this work?
Well, I think we should triple the hospice benefit. Hospices get about $150 a day now to take care of a patient. I think it should be $450 a day. And I think instead of having a six-month limit, you can only get into hospice if you are willing to sign a paper saying you think you're going to die within 6 months and you give up all hopes of cure, all curative treatments. I think if we funded hospice better and we made it at least a one-year benefit, people could get into the system in time to really have some quality of life, to heal some of the family issues that come up at the end of life. So that's essentially what I would do. I have a friend, for example, whose father died in intensive care, and the cost of his 10-day stay was $323,000. This is just totally inappropriate. An 88-year-old man with dementia who'd already signed papers saying he didn't want to be resuscitated and wanted to die a natural death had no business ever being put in intensive care, which is a harrowing death for the families. It's not just a cost issue. But think of all the hospice services $323,000 would cover. I think we need an enormous shift away from these Hail Mary surgeries in the last year of life, Hail Mary ICU stays in the last year of life, and shift all that money, which is being misspent and creating suffering, and shift that over to better funding palliative care services. Obviously, on the national level, we need to be able to fund the simplest of things, which is the thing that was distorted as a death panel, which is a Medicare benefit to allow a doctor to have a really long, deep conversation with you about your end-of-life preferences. This was stripped from Obamacare because it was defined as a death panel. And a congressman named Earl Blumenau is now trying to reintroduce it as a separate standalone bill.
For instance, in your father's case, your father's physician could have had that long discussion before the pacemaker was put in.
Well, exactly. Medicare paid $7,500 to put in the pacemaker. It would have paid the family physician only $54 to discuss whether it was a good idea to do that at all. And my father needed and really benefited from speech therapy. But at that time, Medicare was limiting speech therapy to only $1,500 a year. So there's this penny-wise, pound-foolish approach in Medicare, which is not their fault. It's because of all the lobbyists that have pressured Congress to pressure Medicare to set up a reimbursement system that really doesn't serve patients.
Our next caller is Randy in St. Paul, Minnesota. Hello, Randy.
Hi, Joy. Thanks, Katie. This is such an important topic, and so glad that you're having. My father had dementia for about 8 years, and in the last year of his life, there were all these heroic efforts that were made that were almost comical, but again, resulting in thousands and thousands of dollars of unnecessary medical costs. And I was hoping Katie would have a statistic. I've heard that 80% of the total health care cost an individual has in his lifetime occurs in the last year of life. And I've also heard that a third of our health care expense for the whole country comes from the last 2 years of someone's life. So if she had those statistics, I'd really be appreciative. Thank you.
Yeah. When I was writing Knocking on Heaven's Door, I spent quite a time looking for those statistics, which I had heard repeatedly. The best I could come up with, which was an actual, you know, confirmable statistic, was that a quarter of Medicare spending goes for the last year of life. About a third of people spend time in intensive care in their last year of life, and about a third have a major surgery in the last year of life.
Dave on Facebook writes, American-style disease care is profit-driven to the extreme, As a result, real health care suffers. Is that a part of this?
I really think so. I there's a growing counter movement in medicine called slow medicine, which is sort of equivalent to, you know, slow food movement. And essentially, if we don't start rewarding doctors for their time rather than for doing things to people, we will never adequately fund prevention and careful, wise, slowed down medical decision making.
Let's take another call from Barbara in New Richmond. Hello, Barbara.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. A couple of points. This is a topic very close to my life for the last 3 years. As my father had a slight stroke 3 years ago, ended up dying a few months later, I have to say we were very, very fortunate. He ended up in the hospital with a bowel obstruction after some minor surgery, which he did need to have to, it wasn't to prolong his life, it was to give some comfort to him. But that weekend, the doctors and I, because I was a healthcare agent, had made the decision to provide palliative care, that he did not want to end up in the nursing home as an invalid and then dying within 6 months. It was rather let him go gently and peacefully now. And he was in the acute care intensive care unit, had great palliative care all weekend. The nursing staff, the weekday nursing staff, came in on Sunday evening. When I came in on Monday morning, he was hooked up to all the monitors again and everything. And I said, wait a minute, this is not supposed to be going on. This is what is going to happen. This is how we've been caring for him, and he will be going to hospice today. But their role, their mission, as your guest has said, is to get them recovered and out of the hospital. And the hospitalist and I talked about this and the need for hospital staff to understand that sometimes palliative care is called for. The other point that I wanted to make is...
But I'm sorry, I don't mean to interrupt, Barbara, but it sounds to me like you and the doctor and everybody had agreement that you weren't going to do this, but then somebody in the hospital staff overruled that decision?
Well, they didn't overrule, but somehow when the, I'll say, weekday staff came in, it was, you know, a different staff. Well, they looked at the instructions at the medical record, but just...
They didn't understand, the communication wasn't there.
They didn't understand, yes.
Well, Katie, here Barbara and her doctor are on the same page, but the rest of the hospital staff isn't.
I've heard stories like this over and over. You know, there's a shift change. A different doctor comes in. A different nurse comes in. There's huge variation in the ethics, values, goals of different members of the staff. I think what's important to remember, of course, is that the Supreme Court has given all of us the right, or confirmed our right, to medical autonomy. We have the legal and moral right to ask for the withdrawal of any medical treatment that we feel doesn't serve us. But that message doesn't always filter down to the level of an individual doctor or an individual institution.
Yeah. How important are living wills when it comes to this?
Yeah. I think they're good. But they're only a first step. Hospitals have an expression called the nephew from Peoria. This is the estranged family member who flies in at the last minute, countermands the living will, and insists that everything be done. And because hospitals have a legitimate interest in avoiding lawsuits, if you don't have consensus in the family, often these pieces of paper will not hold up. It's just a beginning, and as our medical world keeps changing, I mean, part of what I write about in the book is that we invented so many means of life-saving in the 1960s that have created these extraordinary moral dilemmas, and they keep shifting. So, for example, most living wills don't say a word about dementia. They are only limited to people who think they're going to die within 6 months or in a coma. They're very extreme in the situations in which they kick in. And also, they don't deal with little tiny life support devices like pacemakers, and even more so, defibrillators, internalized defibrillators can give people shocks on the deathbed if they're not turned off. Mm-hmm. But quite often, they kind of fall through the cracks, and no one takes responsibility for getting them turned off.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that there's an issue with how healthcare workers are trained to think about those near death?
I think especially with doctors. I've interviewed doctors. I've had many, many emails from doctors who are troubled by the direction everything is going. Lots and lots of specialties, including cardiology, get no training in how to have a difficult end-of-life conversation with a patient. And if we don't change medical education to make palliative care or hospice training part of every doctor's training, the doctors are human beings. These are difficult conversations to have. We're a very death-denying culture. So how to even open that conversation? How to know when it's time to stop presenting false hope to people and instead talk about the other deep kinds of healing that can take place at the end of life that don't necessarily mean living longer? This is really an issue, but I actually spent time one time watching decision-making in an intensive care unit. This was 20 years ago. But the nurses were there all day, and they watched the patients suffer. And then the doctors would come in briefly, get an update, and order some more tests or order more procedures. And there was often an unspoken tension between these two fields, with the doctors wanting to be a lot more aggressive and the nurses really being more focused on issues like suffering and what's the end point here? What are we aiming for?
I'm Joy Cardine talking with Katie Butler. She is author of Knocking on Heaven's Door, The Path to a Better Way of Death. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org if you'd like to join in. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We are talking with the author of Knocking on Heaven's Door, The Path to a Better Way of Life. Katie Butler is our guest. Our number is 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Our next caller is Sheila in Milwaukee. Hi, Sheila.
Hi. I have two things for Katie. The first is I wanted to share with her. I just heard on the internet that there is grant research for the very same subject going on at the University of Newcastle in Australia. So this topic is most relevant, especially in the baby boomer generation. I also want to pick up for Katie her statement on deep healing. My mother is dying of cancer and has 6 months to live. And I, while following her, can see that it's fear of the unknown and that's causing this huge stress and making her symptoms worse. And the response to this is continuously medication.
Mm-hmm.
And it is not what's needed. And I'm very, very interested in the mm-hmm. approach to deep healing because I've done hospice care, but I've noticed that nurses are not trained properly to support psychological issues. And neither are these people who come in and are kind enough to stay with the dying person. Doctors avoid it altogether. They're extremely harsh in what they're saying to people who are dying. Who is there to give that deep healing on that hospice team?
Yeah, I think there's huge variety from hospice to hospice. We actually did feel quite spiritually supported. There's a wonderful book called Dying Well by Ira Byock, which I recommend to you. And he advises five psychological tasks of the end of life. Thank you, I love you, please forgive me, I forgive you, and goodbye. And you, as the daughter, can initiate that process with or without talking about death. With my dad, I sent him what I consider legacy letters, thanking him for all the ways he had loved and supported me and taught me when I was a child. So we really got to revisit the kind of honeymoon of when I was 5 years old, and really reaffirm our love for each other before he died. So it was tremendously healing. That kind of work, I think it sounds like you're a little bit on your own and you need to initiate it, and it may give your mother more peace. There's another beautiful book called Sacred Dying, which is an account of how she's like a chaplain in San Francisco, and how she brings ritual, sort of letting go rituals, back into modern life and even into hospital rooms that are very, very beautiful and appropriate for the person. I think we lost so much when we, many of us, abandoned our old religious traditions because we lost these rites of passage that can be so comforting, whether or not you believe in a particular form of God.
Yeah. Sheila, thank you for the call. I'm sorry for what you're going through. Ruth in Madison is with us. Hello, Ruth.
Well, thank you. And before I get to what I wanted to say, you touched on these medical documents that are so inadequate, you know, the like the living will and those other medical documents. And what really bothers me about them is that they lump withholding hydration and withholding nutrition into the same thing. And most Americans can live for a full month without eating and not starve to death. And it's not a bad way to go, to starve to death. But withholding hydration will almost ensure that within a matter of days you're going to have a horrible death from dehydration. And so I think that those things ought to be separated, that a person should be able to choose to be hydrated but not receive nutrition. But what I wanted to say was at the end of, you know, when people that make it into the hospice system and they have certain benefits that that fall to the person who's dying, but also then there's benefits that fall to the family, such as grief counseling that's offered to them free of charge because their loved one was in the hospice system. Now, if three-quarters of the people don't die in the hospice system, then there's three-quarters of the people who are not eligible for this free grief counseling. And I think that either because they need to be funded better, we should also open it up to anyone who's got a loved one who died could have this grief counseling, you know, or, like you say, more people need to get into hospice, and this has to be better funded.
Wonderful. I really couldn't agree more. And we are wasting at least $150 billion a year in our healthcare system. And if that money was redirected, we could fund all this very well.
Kathy on Facebook asks, how do loved ones address the situation with their doctor? And how do we get over the guilt in the heat of the moment? My mother had a do not resuscitate, and her doctor knew she did not want to continue living. My mother is home, and her mind is sharp, but she has a very diminished quality of life with a pacemaker keeping her running. So, I guess, in retrospect.
Right, and I think it's tough, and I just keep advising people to get into the palliative care system. You need to find doctors who share your values, because you're up against a brick wall if a doctor feels very strongly that morally or ethically he does not want to participate in something like turning off a pacemaker. The legalities and the morality of it are very clear. The major cardiac associations have all declared that it is neither assisted suicide nor is it euthanasia. However, there are doctors who just don't feel that way, and if that's the case, don't keep knocking on a closed door. Move to a different door. Find a different door.
Our next caller is Nina. Oops, wrong button. Let's go to Nina in Wausau. Hello, Nina.
Hello, good morning. Again, I want to just reiterate so many callers. Thank you so much for this program. I'm in the healthcare business. I've been in that field for 35 years, all the way from emergency services to chief nursing officer. And I can tell you, if we wait for Congress to legislate anything about this or Medicare to do anything about it, we're going to be waiting a long time. And the physicians who are sort of focused on profit making and revenues aren't going to do anything about it either. My mother died at home. We had 5 months to prepare for her and help her with that process. My dad got sick, was in a skilled nursing facility, got sick with pneumonia, and 3 or 4 days later, he was gone. The key to all of this is really keeping in contact with primary care and making sure you know who the palliative care providers are in your hospital and community. They are healthcare's best kept secret. And I think the other key is really to educate families and patients and have everything you want really written down. I can't underscore more how hard this is for families. I'm very well educated. I was very well prepared. My mom and I had lots of great discussions. My dad and I talked about what would happen at the end of his life many, many times. And for my mom, it was right at the last hour in the middle of the night. I almost balked and sent her to the hospital, just questioning my own decisions. And my dad, you know, the healthcare system finally wore me down. And at 3:30 in the morning, when I was getting badgered by this skilled nursing facility physician on call who didn't know my dad at all, I sent him to the hospital. It was interesting there. You know, his physician was a geriatrician, and I think that's very important for people in that age group because geriatricians are much more focused on end-of-life support and quality at end-of-life and really engage the families if families can be engaged with the process. But it's so important to make sure that primary care and the families are driving the decisions and not the hospitals or the for-profit physicians. You know, it's a very, very, very difficult process, but I think those are the keys. We can't wait for our government or our healthcare system to do it. We have to start it from families and patients.
Thank you, Nina. Katie?
Yeah, wonderful. I think it's sort of like just say no. I mean, you can just say no. My husband's Aunt Dot was 92 years old and in the hospital after she fainted, and her son, who had only a high school education, absolutely refused to allow them to keep her overnight. And they kind of threatened him and said, are you saying you want to deny your mother medical care and sign her out against medical advice? And he said, look, she was halfway through eating a piece of red velvet cake, and all she wants to do is go home and finish that cake, and that's what we're going to do. And he just took her home, and that's really what he did for the next 5 years when she finally died in her own bed without any of these elaborate and very painful and traumatic medical procedures.
To what degree does advocating for a family member or for yourself for that matter rely on having good relationships to your healthcare provider?
Well, I think it's huge, just as that prior caller said, someone who's in geriatrics, primary care, hospice, palliative care, these people want to know you and want to understand your values and what you consider an adequate quality of life. It's when we get into the high-tech specialties, which in special situations may be just what you want, but as your decision makers and drivers, I don't think so. They don't know you.
And Nina said if we're going to wait for Congress to change anything, we're going to be waiting a very long time. What are your thoughts on whether or not...
Well, I hope she's wrong. I really hope that the book, Knocking on Heaven's Door, inspires people to get informed not only personally but politically, because I do think that these reimbursement structures make it almost very, very difficult for doctors to do the right thing and very easy to do the wrong thing. As it's structured now, a doctor who recommends chemo will get 6% of the cost of the chemo on top of his other fees. But if he has a long discussion with the family about the fact that chemo is no longer effective, he'll essentially not get paid at all, and he'll lose the 6% for not continuing to do the futile chemo. I mean, in a system like that, you know, how are you going to make fundamental structural changes if you don't change that reimbursement? And I do think we have one thing going for us, which is that this end-of-life care that we are currently, our sort of default mode of end-of-life care, not only creates enormous suffering for families and the person who's dying, but it's also incredibly wasteful and expensive. So there is a possibility of a coming together of the forces that don't want to waste money in government, and the families and the caregivers and the prospective patients themselves, there is some possibility for at least some of this shifting and getting better.
Nina, thank you for the call. Artis in Jefferson is with us. Hello.
Hello. I don't know if I'll make it through this. I just lost my mother yesterday.
I'm sorry.
She had had some major surgery done on Wednesday and never came to. So they were, she was on an oxygen mask that covered her whole face, and they had her on medication to keep her heart rate down and a medication to keep her blood pressure up and lots of fluids to help her. She only had one kidney to make sure that kept functioning. And slowly, even us children could see things weren't getting better. And by yesterday, there's four of us. Unfortunately, the fourth one, my sister, is in Fort Leavenworth, Kansas, so she couldn't be there. So my two brothers and I, and with her on the phone, we made the decision to change from giving her all this fluid and such to just giving her comfort care. And so we did. So they gave her morphine and Ativan. And from what we could tell, and of course, we're not medical people, she just passed away. Mm-hmm. Took about half an hour, and she was gone. Mm-hmm. But, you know, did we do the right thing? We don't know. We'll never know till we get to heaven and see her again. But it was very hard to do.
Yeah.
But we knew if she had come to, she probably would have been on oxygen, which she wouldn't have minded, but she could have been on dialysis. We knew she didn't want that. And they had taken out all of her colon, so she had a colostomy bag, and she would have been just very upset with that. So we decided, okay, what kind of quality of life is mother going to have if she ever does come to? I mean, she didn't open her eyes. She didn't follow any commands.
Right, Artis, and I'm so sorry for your loss and that difficult decision you faced. And we only, unfortunately, have a minute to go. Katie, do you have any
yeah,
last words?
Yeah, just to say I totally resonate and feel with you. And for me, it got easier over time. Looking back, I can see clearly that we really did do the loving thing, the wise thing, the moral thing. I don't think it's God's plan for us to layer additional suffering on top of the necessary and ordinary suffering of dying and letting go.
We'll leave it there. Katie, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Katie Butler is a science writer. She is the author of Knocking on Heaven's Door, The Path to a Better Way of Death. Thanks very much to Christy Taylor for producing and directing this program. Thanks to Bill Martins for on-air production. Thank you for listening. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.